So Lumpaz just asked me to do a couple of the readings. He's pretty much organized it and chosen these, but just to give a break so he doesn't have to talk the whole time. He asked if I would do some of the readings as well. And this one is, as he was saying, from this book called Samana by Lungpa Mahabua, Ajahn Mahabua. And gave a little background there, but Ajahn Mahabua died at the age of 97, just a couple of years ago, 2011. And this book here was published after he passed away. The first section that I'm going to read out is a little bit autobiographical, just about his growing up and some of his time with his family and the culture that he grew up in. And even though it's specific to Lungpa Mahabua himself, it kind of gives a nice flavor of the environment that this generation of Thai forest masters grew up in, the kind of the culture and the surroundings, the people. So that's this first part here. My mother was a wonderfully patient and devoted woman. She told me that of all the 16 children she carried to birth, I was by far the most troublesome in the womb. I was either so still in her stomach that she thought I must have already died, or I was thrashing around so violently that she thought I must have been on the verge of death. The closer I came to birth, the worse those extremes became. Just before I was born, my mother and my father each had an auspicious dream. My father dreamed that he had received a very sharp knife pointed at the tip with an elephant husk handle and encased in a silver sheath. My father felt very pleased. My mother, on the other hand, dreamed that she had received a pair of gold earrings which were so lovely that she couldn't resist the temptation to put them on and admire herself in the mirror. The more she looked, the more they impressed her. My grandfather interpreted these two dreams to mean that the course of my life would follow one of two extremes. If I chose the way of evil, I would be the most feared criminal of my time. My character would be so fearsome that I was bound to end up being a crime boss of unprecedented daring and ferocity, who'd never allow himself to be captured alive and imprisoned, but would hide out in the jungle and fight the authorities to the death. At the other extreme, if I chose the way of virtue, my goodness would be unequaled. I'd be bound to ordain as a Buddhist monk and become a field of merit for the world. When I grew up, I noticed that all the older boys were getting married, so I thought that's what I wanted too. One day, an old fortune teller came to visit the house of my friend. In the course of conversation, my friend blurted out that he wanted to ordain as a monk. The old man looked a bit annoyed and then asked to see the boy's hand. "Let's take a look at the lines in your palm to see if you're really going to be a monk." "Oh, look at this. There's no way you'll ordain." "But I really want to ordain." "No way. You'll get married first." I suddenly got an itch to ask the old man about my fortune, since I was hoping to marry at that time. I had no intention to ordain. When I stuck my hand out, the old man grabbed it and exclaimed, "This is the guy that's going to ordain." "But I want to get married." "No way. Your ordination line is full. Before long, you'll be a monk." My face went flush because I wasn't intending to be a monk at all. I wanted to have a wife. It was strange, really. After that, whenever I thought of marrying a girl, some obstacle would arise to prevent it. I even had a narrow escape after I ordained, when a girl I previously had a crush on came looking for me at the monastery, only to find that I had just moved to another place. If she'd caught me in time, who knows? While I was growing up, I had no particular desire to become a monk. It took me a while to focus my attention on it. When I was 20, I fell seriously ill, so ill that my parents were constantly sitting at my bedside. My physical symptoms were severe. At the same time, a decision on whether or not to ordain weighed heavily on my mind. I felt the Lord of Death closing in on me. My whole life seemed to be in the balance. My parents sat anxiously beside me, not daring to speak. My mother, who was usually very talkative, just sat there crying. Eventually, my father couldn't hold back his tears. They both thought I was going to die that night. Seeing my parents crying in despair, I made the solemn vow that should I recover from that illness, I would ordain as a Buddhist monk for their sake. As though in response to my intense resolve, my symptoms began to slowly fade away. By dawn, they had disappeared completely. Instead of dying that night, as expected, I made a full recovery. But following my recovery, the intensity of my resolve waned. My inner virtue kept reminding me that I had made a solemn promise to ordain. So why was I procrastinating? Several months of indecision passed, even though I kept acknowledging my failure to live up to my resolution. Why hadn't I ordained yet? I knew I had no choice but to ordain. I had to honor the agreement I made with the Lord of Death, my life in exchange for ordination. I willingly conceded that ordination was inevitable. I wasn't trying to avoid it, but I needed a catalyst. That catalyst came during a frank discussion with my mother. Both she and my father were pleading with me to ordain. Finally, their tears forced me to make the decision that marked my path in life. My father wanted me to ordain so badly that he began to cry. As soon as my father started crying, I was startled. My father's tears were no small matter. I reflected on my father's tears for 3 days before finalizing my decision. At the end of the third day, I approached my mother and announced my intention to ordain, adding the provision that I be allowed the freedom to give up the robes whenever I felt inclined. I made it clear that I wouldn't ordain if I was forbidden to disrobe. But my mother was too clever. She said that if I wanted to disrobe immediately after the ordination ceremony, in front of all the people in attendance, she wouldn't object. She'd be satisfied to see me standing there in yellow robes. That was all she asked. Of course, who would be foolish enough to immediately disrobe right there in front of the preceptor with the whole village in attendance? My mother easily outsmarted me on that one. Soon after my ordination, I began reading the story of the Buddha's life, which immediately awakened a strong sense of faith in my heart. I was so moved by the Buddha's struggle to attain enlightenment that tears rolled down my cheeks as I read. Contemplating the scope of his attainment instilled in me a fervent desire to gain release from suffering. Toward that purpose, I decided to formally study the Buddha's teachings as a preparation for putting them into practice. With that aim in mind, I made a solemn vow to complete the third grade of Pali studies. As soon as I passed the third level Pali exams, I planned to follow the way of practice. I had no intention to study further or take exams for the higher levels. When I traveled to Chiang Mai to take my exams, by chance, Venerable Ajahn Mun arrived at Wat Chedi Luang in Chiang Mai at the time I did. As soon as I learned that he was staying there, I was overwhelmed with joy. When I returned for my alms round next morning, I learned from another monk that Ajahn Mun left for alms on a certain path and returned by the very same path. This made me even more eager to see him. Even if I couldn't meet him face to face, I'd be content just to have a glimpse of him before he left. The next morning, before Ajahn Mun went on his alms round, I hurried out early for alms and then returned to my quarters. From there, I kept watch on the path by which he would return, and before long I saw him coming. With a longing that came from having wanted to see him for such a long time, I peeked out from my hiding place to catch a glimpse of him. The moment I saw him, a feeling of complete faith arose within me. I felt that because I had now seen an Arahant, I hadn't wasted my birth as a human being. Although no one had told me that he was an Arahant, my heart became firmly convinced of it the moment I saw him. At the same time, a feeling of sudden elation, hard to describe, came over me, making my hair stand on end. The story of his ordination up to the time he saw Ajahn Mun for the first time. Good example of the awakening of the quality of faith. Mm-hmm. So another section here. Comparing myself with Venerable Ajahn Mun, I could see that we were very different. When Ajahn Mun looked at something, he comprehended it thoroughly and in a way that was just right from every angle in the heart. He never focused on only one side, but always used wisdom to see the broader picture. This lesson I learned many times while living with him. In that way, studying with Ajahn Mun wasn't simply a matter of studying teachings about the Dhamma. I had to adapt myself to the practices he followed until they were firmly in my own thoughts, words, and deeds. Living with him for a long time allowed me to gradually observe his habits and his practices, and to understand the reasoning behind them, until that knowledge was firmly embedded in my heart. I felt a great sense of security while living with him, because he himself was all Dhamma. At the same time, staying in his presence forced me to be always watchful and restrained. Ajahn Mun had a habit of chanting every night for several hours. Hearing him softly chanting in his hut one evening, I had the mischievous urge to sneak up and listen. I wanted to find out what he chanted at such length every night. But as soon as I crept up close enough to hear him clearly, his voice stopped and remained silent. This didn't look good, so I quickly backed away and stood listening from a distance. No sooner had I backed away than I heard the low cadence of his chanting start up again, now too faint to be heard clearly. So again I sneaked forward, and again he went silent. In the end, I never did find out what he was chanting. I was afraid that if I stubbornly insisted on eavesdropping, a bolt of lightning might strike and a sharply deep thunder out. Meeting him the next morning, I glanced away. I did not dare look him in the face. But he looked directly at me with a sharp, menacing glare. I learned my lesson the hard way. Never again did I dare to sneak up and try to listen in on his chanting. I was afraid I would receive something severe for my trouble. I had heard that Ajahn Mun could read other people's minds, and this intrigued me. So one day I decided to test him to see if it was true. Ajahn Mun would. In the afternoon, I prostrated 3 times before the Buddha statue and set up a determination in my heart. Should Ajahn Mun know what I am thinking at this moment, then let me receive a clear and unmistakable sign that will dispel all my doubts. Later that afternoon, I went to Ajahn Mun's hut to pay my respects. When I arrived, he was sewing patches on his robes, so I offered to help. As soon as I approached him, his expression changed and his eyes grew fierce. Something didn't feel right. I tentatively put my hand out to take a piece of cloth, but he quickly snatched it from my grasp with a short grunt of displeasure. "Don't be a nuisance." Things didn't look good at all, so I sat quietly and waited. After a few minutes of tense silence, Ajahn Mun spoke. Normally, a practicing monk has to pay attention to his own mind and observe his own thoughts. Unless he's crazy, he doesn't expect someone else to look into his mind for him. In the lengthy silence that followed, I felt humbled and my mind surrendered to him completely. I made a solemn vow never again to challenge Ajahn Mun. After that, I respectfully asked permission to help him sew his robe, and he made no objection. A little taste of Ajahn Mahabua and a little vision of what Ajahn Mun was like from his eyes.